You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times travel section, read by Michelle Wexler. This is being recorded on March 22nd, 2024. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. How do you paddle a disappearing river? Written by Daniel Modlin. And Hidden Cameras, What Travelers Need to Know, written by Elaine Glusak, and following up with miscellaneous articles. We begin with the first article, How Do You Paddle a Disappearing River? Canoeing the Rio Grande near Big Bend National Park can be magical. But as the river dries, it's getting harder to find where a boat will actually float. This by Daniel Modlin. Daniel Modlin is a reporter who has covered Far West Texas extensively. I had barely unbuckled my seatbelt and was already wondering if I had driven 6 hours across Texas for nothing. A once-in-a-lifetime river adventure had seemingly evaporated with some disappointing news. It was the promise of a 4-day, 33-mile canoe journey in Big Bend National Park, snaking through awe-inspiring canyons on a mighty river that had lured me across the state. My partner's brother, Michael Stengel, an occasional guide with Hidden Dagger Adventures, had offered to take me on the Rio Grande, one of the country's longest rivers, which stretches from central Colorado to the Gulf of Mexico. I had only previously visited Big Bend on foot, and I was excited to see it from the water. The moment I pulled into Michael's driveway in Alpine, Texas, after driving there from Austin last April, he told me, we wouldn't be going through the park anymore. Unless you want to go hiking with a canoe, we should run a different part of the river, he said. Having just returned from that segment of the river between Rio Grande Village, a small campground within Big Bend, and Heath Canyon Ranch, just outside the park, he said it had been more work than fun, and that he had been dragging the canoe for a quarter of a mile at a time over nearly dry riverbeds. Instead, we would be doing the Temple Canyon route, an 11-mile, 2-night, 3-day stretch of the Rio Grande, following the United States-Mexico border more than 30 miles from where our original trip was supposed to begin. This different river segment, entirely outside and downstream from Big Bend, was instead within a desert bighorn sheep restoration area known as Black Gap. Even though I was disappointed, I came to learn that last-minute changes to adventures involving the Rio Grande were common. If the river were a heart, it would be flatlining. The Rio Grande is in peril. Its water is being depleted by farmers and cities, while a climate change-induced megadrought that has desiccated the American Southwest for more than 2 decades is threatening hopes of its recovery. In 2022, the river ran dry in Albuquerque for the first time in 4 decades. In the same year, the picturesque Santa Elena Canyon, one of the most popular sites in Big Bend, also ran dry, for the first time in at least 15 years, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. If the river were a heart, it would be flatlining, said Samuel Sandoval Solis, an associate professor at the University of California, Davis, studying water management. For the West Texan River Guides, it's simply another precarious reality of life in the Chihuahuan Desert. In my lifetime, I expect river trips to no longer be feasible, said Charlie Angel of Angel Expeditions, a tour guide service based in Redford, Texas. For now, those booking paddling tours on the Rio Grande can expect last-minute switch-ups if they want their boats to actually float. When guests book over the phone, we tell them, you're going to go where we tell you we're going, said Mike Nakarato, the founder of Far West Texas Outfitters, an adventure company based in Presidio, Texas. And if they still insist on wanting to go to Big Bend National Park when the levels are low, we tell them it's their choice. We can either do it by dragging the boat up and down the river, or we can go do this very, very pretty trip outside of the park, but still on the Rio Grande instead. While the high season for river trips is typically March through May, and following monsoon season from September through November, local tour operators are struggling to predict when the water levels will be high enough. It's really hard to say anything is normal nowadays. We've started calling it non-soon season, said Mr. Nakarato. Dragging, zigzagging, and headbutting. After an hour-long drive with canoes strapped to Michael's truck, we stood on the edge of the river outside Heath Canyon Ranch, staring at an out-of-commission bridge stretching across the border to Mexico. While the sun was hidden behind clouds, I was already drenched in sweat from lugging the gear-filled canoes to the bank. It was soon clear our easier 11-mile journey would still be hard work because of the river's lower-than-normal water levels. Within about 30 seconds of pushing off, Michael and I reached our first rapid section, and I, a river novice, was ill-prepared. The lower water levels had left protruding rocks that we would have to navigate. Michael hopped out of his canoe and grabbed my bow. You're going to have to angle the nose directly toward that Y, where the river's splitting and it's turning white. Then tilt the nose quickly right, then quickly left, he instructed. My canoe ended up jammed on a gravel bed, and I was forced to hump it over rocks until the river deepened. It happened again and again. At nearly every rapid section, and it felt as if one came around every time I started to gain confidence, my boat ended up beached. I must have spent more time out of my boat pushing it than in it paddling. Even in sections where the river deepened, it wasn't easy. Instead of the current pulling us swiftly down the middle, the lower water levels forced our boats to drift in a serpentine formation, back and forth across the banks of the river. The banks provided another problem. For most of our trip, the right bank of the river, the Mexican side, was dominated by carrizo cane. Also known as border bamboo or giant reed, the cane, an invasive species, stretched off the bank for what I estimated as up to 15 feet high. The turbulent and narrow river dragged my boat right into the cane, which cut up my arms and legs and clotheslined me into the water. Michael instructed me to counterintuitively lean forward into the cane, not away from it. When I heeded his advice, my unhelmeted head became a blunt object upon which the cane snapped itself in half. It was significantly better than capsizing. That night, blistered, bruised, and damp, I asked Michael as we sat on our sleeping pads if floating the Rio was always this strenuous and riddled with obstacles. "Not when there's really water," he said. In fact, as I later learned, most of the difficulties I encountered, beyond stepping in cow dung near the campsite, could be attributed to the river's lower water levels and signs of the landscape shifting as a result, said Jeff Bennett, a hydrologist for the Rio Grande Joint Venture, a conservation group that strives to protect the river habitat. Boulders, gravel, sand, and this invasive cane are no longer getting washed downstream, Mr. Bennett said in a phone interview. A flood would remedy all of that. A journey worth the bruises. On the last morning of the trip, we salvaged a few soggy sandwiches from the bottom of our coolers and shoved off. The river was calm for the few miles we had left, and we saw turtles called Big Bend sliders sunbathing on the rocks. The last challenge the river dealt us was leaving it. We floated right past the takeout point, which was shrouded in cane, and we had to paddle back upstream for a quarter of a mile. Unlike the previous spots on the river where we had pulled our canoes ashore, this one was surprisingly deep, with the river rising to my chest. Instead of a gentle slope, like the places where we had made camp along our journey, the takeout was more or less a 60-degree sand dune stretching for 20 yards. After lugging my boat through the sand, I collapsed, wet, bruised, and spent, with only enough energy to dissociate into the cloudless sky. We think the river has changed, but really, we have changed the river, Dr. Sandoval Solis, the UC Davis associate professor, told me months later, when I was back home among my creature comforts, adding that he believed it was still possible to return the river to its once powerful state through proper water management practices. The river has a much better memory than we do. He is correct about its memory. When the rains come, the river remembers its identity as an eons-old canyon carver, even if we know it only as a gasping, dwindling giant. He is correct about our flawed memory, too, because when I think of my trip, the cane thwacking me, stepping in cow dung, or the change of plans isn't what I recall first. Instead, I think of lying out under a blanket of stars, passing a bottle of mezcal back and forth in between hands of cards, listening to the brays of burros echoing from cliff to cliff, canyon to canyon, bank to bank. And I want to do it, all of it, again. I just hope there's enough river for next time. That story, How Do You Paddle a Disappearing River, written by Daniel Modlin. And next up, Hidden Cameras, What Travelers Need to Know. We talked to security and privacy experts about Airbnb's new ban on surveillance cameras, your privacy rights, and how to find a hidden camera. This by Elaine Glusak. This month, Airbnb announced that starting April 30th, the company would ban the use of surveillance cameras in its rentals. The news was welcomed by those concerned about privacy. "Cameras are both creepy and a threat," said Albert Fox Kahn, the executive director of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, which has campaigned for a ban on cameras in Airbnbs since 2022. "People are terrified about having their intimate moments photographed without their consent and having owners able to monitor their activities within a rental." For many travelers, Airbnb's new policy has prompted some fundamental questions. What were the cameras doing there in the first place? And what are travelers' rights when it comes to privacy in hotels and rental homes? Public use of cameras. Cameras, of course, are everywhere in public life, from the self-checkout kiosks at big box retailers to airport terminals. Like other businesses, hotels and vacation rentals use surveillance cameras for two reasons, said Michael McCall, a Hilton Hotels fellow in the School of Hospitality Business at Michigan State University: to protect their customers and their property. A traveler might feel more secure getting to a hotel room or rental apartment with a security camera in a hallway, for example. And a hotel or host might use cameras to monitor property damage or theft, though the question of whether surveillance is effective in preventing crime is a long-standing debate between privacy and safety advocates. "There's a balance between how do I protect my stuff and at the same time not intrude on the expected privacy of the guest," Mr. McCall said. Airbnb said the inside is off limits. States vary on whether and what degree of consent is required for surveillance, and there are different rules for audio and video recording. U.S. privacy law is fragmented at best, wrote Doris Del Tosto Brogan, a law professor and the Heller McGinnis Endowed Leadership Chair at Villanova University's Charles Widger School of Law in Villanova, Pennsylvania, in an email. She noted that some federal privacy statutes apply to all states, but that each state can develop its own privacy laws. Airbnb previously navigated these shoals by requiring that indoor cameras in common spaces, such as hallways and kitchens, had to be disclosed to the renter. Since 2022, the short-term rental platform Vrbo has banned the use of indoor cameras except for those that are disclosed to guests and can be deactivated by them. In a statement, the American Hotel and Lodging Association, which represents 80% of all franchised hotels in the United States, said surveillance cameras in hotels should be limited to common areas, like lobbies and pools, for security purposes. Reasonable expectation of privacy. Though regulations vary by state, more legal protections cover non-consensual videotaping in private areas such as bedrooms and bathrooms. At the federal level, the Video Voyeurism Prevention Act of 2004 prohibits knowingly videotaping, photographing, filming, recording by any means, or broadcasting an image of a private area of an individual without that individual's consent, under circumstances in which that individual has a reasonable expectation of privacy. Many states, as well as federal laws, hinge on the expectation of privacy. So that would be often, for example, a bedroom or a bathroom, but not necessarily a common area, like a living room, said Raymond Koo, the John Homer Catt Professor of Law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law in Cleveland, Ohio. But it's the illegal use of hidden cameras that have shocked travelers. Earlier this month, a Royal Caribbean cruise ship cabin attendant was arrested on federal charges for producing and possessing child pornography by installing video cameras inside guests' bathrooms and capturing intimate images of passengers as young as 10. In February, a man was arrested in Palm Beach County in Florida on charges of video voyeurism for surreptitiously videotaping 16 different people, sometimes at Airbnb locations. In September, a 14-year-old passenger on an American Airlines plane discovered an iPhone taped to a toilet seat that her family said a flight attendant had installed. Legal and security experts believe such invasions are the exceptions, considering the millions of people who travel daily, but that they warrant vigilance. People who want to use cameras for nefarious reasons are still in the game, said Kenneth Bombace, the chief executive of the intelligence firm Global Threat Solutions, describing a new generation of recording devices that are small, subtle, and inexpensive. How to find hidden cameras. In his business, Mr. Bombace uses high-tech devices to conduct searches, from hotel rooms to corporate boardrooms, for hidden recording devices. For travelers without a high profile or celebrity status, he recommends a common-sense search of a location. This includes looking for small recording devices or telltale lenses in anything connected to a power source, such as a clock radio, power outlets themselves, and battery-charged electronics, such as smoke detectors and Bluetooth speakers. Turn off the lights and use a flashlight. A cell phone flashlight will do, to look for flashing lights that might reveal a camera. If you're uncertain, you can throw a towel over an electronic device or tape over the outlets. Because many recording devices require an internet connection to stream images, check the Wi-Fi network for any connected devices and ask the homeowner or manager what they are. Apps such as Network Analyzer and Ubiquiti Wi-Fi-Man will scan networks and detect connected devices. Numerous portable gadgets on Amazon priced at less than $150 claim to detect hidden cameras. None of the technologies are 100% effective, but they mitigate and lower the chances of a recording device going undetected, Mr. Bombace said. What recourse do you have? If you find a hidden camera in a hotel room or short-term rental, gather evidence by taking pictures or videos and contacting the police. Then find new accommodations. Airbnb directs guests to report privacy violations to its customer support team. Vrbo does the same, noting on its website that if you leave a property because of the violation, the host may be required to refund the entirety of the stay and could be kicked off the platform. Hosts still have methods to ensure their property rules aren't being abused. Both Vrbo and Airbnb allow hosts to use devices outdoors that measure sound decibels without recording conversations if they are disclosed to renters. Vrbo cites their use as fending off potential noise complaints from neighbors. Airbnb, which has a ban on party houses, says the devices may detect unauthorized parties. The platforms still allow external cameras at rental properties as long as they are disclosed to the guest before arrival. The disclosure is usually included in the listing, and the device should not be used to peep indoors. Vrbo goes even further regarding outdoor pool cameras, requiring notice both in property descriptions and on site. You've been warned. Spontaneous skinny dipping in the pool could be captured on camera. That story, Hidden Cameras, What Travelers Need to Know, written by Elaine Glusak. Elaine Glusak is the Frugal Traveler columnist focusing on budget-friendly tips and journeys. And finally, 8 incidents in 2 weeks. What's going on with United's planes? While no one was injured, most of the mishaps required emergency landings or diversions. One safety expert said the incidents were not the result of systemic problems. This by Christine Chung. An engine fire sparked by plastic packaging wrap, a tire lost shortly after takeoff, and a plane veering off the runway. These are among the 8 incidents that have occurred over the past 2 weeks on flights operated by United Airlines. While no injuries or worse have been reported, the mishaps have generated headlines and stoked rising anxiety about aviation safety among federal officials and passengers alike. All of the incidents happened on flights that took off from or were headed to airports in the United States, and 5 involved airplanes made by Boeing, a manufacturer already under intense scrutiny. In January, a door plug blew out of an Alaska Airlines Boeing 737 MAX 9 jetliner in mid-flight, forcing the plane to make an emergency landing. United, one of the world's largest airlines, flies aircraft manufactured mainly by Boeing and Airbus. In an email United began sending to customers on Monday, the company's chief executive, Scott Kirby, wrote that while the recent incidents were unrelated, they were reminders of the importance of safety. "I want you to know that these incidents have our attention and have sharpened our focus," he continued, adding that every case was being reviewed by the airline and would influence its safety training and procedures. Here's what travelers should know about the latest in airplane woes. What exactly happened on or to the planes? Most of the incidents reported in the last 2 weeks required emergency landings or diversions. March 4th, a Boeing 737-900 departing from George Bush Intercontinental Airport in Houston returned to the airport to make an emergency landing after one of the plane engines ingested and burned plastic wrap. March 7th, a Boeing 777 leaving San Francisco for Osaka, Japan, made an emergency landing at Los Angeles International Airport after the aircraft lost a tire. March 8th, a Boeing 737 MAX 8 veered off the runway upon landing at George Bush Airport in Houston and tilted onto the grass. Later that day, a flight leaving San Francisco for Mexico City was diverted to Los Angeles after the Airbus A320 experienced issues with its hydraulic system. And March 9th, an Airbus A320 headed to Salt Lake City turned back to Chicago O'Hare International Airport after it reported maintenance issues. March 11th, a Boeing 777 flying from Sydney, Australia to San Francisco turned back after takeoff because the plane had a hydraulic leak. And that's all we have time for. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Travel Section, read by Michelle Wexler.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.